We have lightning bugs who have returned to our neighborhood, and out in the heat last night, I noticed that their lights were very brief. It used to be that the lightning bugs, at least in my memory, would shine on for a good second or so before turning off, and last night it was just, they were just blinking. Was it part of the heat? Do you have an insect question today? Because we've got the guest for you. It's the Lee Rayburn Show, and joining us this hour is Phil Pelletieri. He's an entomologist, a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, and he retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab back in 2014. What have you been seeing in our insect world? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've got a bug picture you'd like to send along, email talk@wpr.org. And Phil, I want to thank you so much for returning with us today.
It's nice to be back.
Let's start with those lightning bugs. Are those brief flashes that I noticed last night, is that just a weird observation, or is that a result of the heat? Are lightning bugs and other insects acting differently with the heat and now the smoke?
Well, the heat in particular, insects being cold-blooded, everything they do is temperature regulated. So the warmer it is, the faster that things happen. So that's one potential. The second, though, is there's a number of species of fireflies in the state. And so the ones you experienced when you were younger are not necessarily the ones that you're seeing now.
And we talked in the past about how lightning bugs, folks say, well, I don't see lightning bugs anymore, and how they're sort of transitory, that they can show up in one place one summer and move along to a different place in another summer. Is that about right?
Yeah, although, you know, overall, I tend to expect them the year after a lush growing season, because their larvae are predators and they feed on some things like millipedes and the like that do well under moisture. So there is that relationship. It was interesting this year. It was just about the 4th of July that all of a sudden they started showing. My neighbors, in fact, even brought up the question, where were they? And it's just, speculating that things that they saw before, maybe in May and June, in different years, were different species.
Huh. Well, that helps answer that, and I'll keep an eye on it. I also want to keep an eye on this, and maybe it also has something to do with our changing climate. Yesterday, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services confirmed the first West Nile virus activity in our state this summer. It's been found in mosquitoes in Milwaukee County and a bird in Bayfield, but no reported human activity yet. How concerned are you about this, and what can we do about it?
It's always a late summer issue. And, the two competing factors, the mosquito that's involved with it is primarily a bird feeder. In the spring of the year, it seems to concentrate on birds, which gives it a chance to pick up the virus. But then in the summer, it has what we call a host change, so they're more likely to bite people. So the way it's looked for is, again, mosquitoes are sampled, and when the first virus shows up, we know it's something we have to keep abreast of. This remains to be seen where this will go, but this is kind of like, the light's on, so we better keep our eyes open and see what happens. Now, the thing with West Nile, it's interesting, is people can get the disease and not show any symptoms. but some people do have some severe complications, and it can even be life-threatening. And so, as I said, it does good to do your mosquito control as best as possible. I will say, with the drier weather that's moving in, that should hold the mosquitoes numbers down, at least in the short run.
Do you use DEET to prevent mosquito bites?
A little bit. Honestly, I've got some permethrin-impregnated clothing that I use both for tick control and when I go in places. So I have long sleeve. They're light shirts, but long sleeve with permethrin on them. And boy, that really does make a difference.
Let's go to your questions now for our guest, entomologist Phil Pelletieri, 1-800-642-1234. We'll start with Tom in Algoma. Tom, hi.
Hi. I've got what might be a silly question, but I like macro photography. And getting insects to stand still and pose for pictures is not an easy thing. They don't like to cooperate. Is there some way that something that can be done to anesthetize them so they just sit there for a little bit, I get my picture, and then they're gone?
So your idea is to medicate these insects so that they'll stay still and strike a pose for you, Tom?
Well, pretty much, yeah. I'm thinking I could make up a, use a 2-liter bottle, cut the bottom off of it, set that over the insect, and put something in that bottle that'll medicate them. I like that.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, back in the day, we used to use ether when we were collecting insects, and that would, but the trouble is that paralyzes them. Okay. So what we would do if we really want to try to get it is, because again, they're cold blooded. If you can catch something, put it in the fridge and give it some time to cool down, then it's going to take some time for its body to warm up and become more active. And so that's the trick. The other one I know photographers use at times is going out in cool mornings, you know, for dragonflies and other things that are real stinkers to get to stand still. They would often go when it was cool enough that the dragonfly just wasn't quite there yet. And so they were quite stationary. And so some insects are more difficult than others. And I really do. That's one of the things that an entomologist admires, some of the incredible photographs of insects like robber flies and tiger beetles that are just so nervous and so active. Anybody that gets a good picture of those, I am duly impressed.
But I would also think it might have something to do with your camera, that a quick f-stops, a shutter that opens and closes almost instantaneously with the right kind of light could capture the same thing in the wild.
But again, it just makes life so much better if the critters are just stationary for a while. And as I said, I use the trick of the refrigerator before. You can't quite put them in the freezer too long. A big shock is likely to kill an insect, even an insect that is relatively cold hardy. But putting things in the refrigerator for 10 minutes or whatnot just to get them to settle down, it is a trick that I think would work pretty well.
Start cool, Tom, or get them cool, and that might be your best bet to capture that picture you're looking for. And thank you for the call, and appreciate the answer, Phil. Let's go to David in Verona next. Hi, David.
Hi, Lee. I have a 35-year-old prairie in my backyard, and about 10 years ago, we noticed that it began to be habitat for chiggers, so that every time we went out into the prairie, we would get a bunch of chigger bites. And they've sort of spread a little bit into the yard, so that if we even work near the prairie, we get them. Mm. I'm wondering if Professor Pelletieri knows how to control chiggers in the environment, not the bites that you get from them. I'm a doctor, and I understand how to do that. It's more, how do I keep them out of my prairie?
First of all, Phil, what is a chigger?
So it's technically a mite, and they are honestly, in most cases, mites that are predaceous on insect eggs and other insects. And the whole thing about messing with people is it's a dead end. They burrow in, they leave some body fluids behind, which is what we react to, but they're often gone for a number of hours, if not a day or more, after your exposure. But then again, you've got the painful issue of dealing with those bites, which for some people will last for a couple weeks, if not more. Mm. So it's a very unpleasant experience. A lot of times you pick up the bites along confined clothing areas, sock line, belt line, and the like. That's classic if you've got mysterious bites that tend to weep in the summer. Now, the problem is the environment that you've got is almost impossible to manipulate away unless you get rid of the prairie. I mean, if you had a open sand pit, there would be no chiggers. But that is not realistic. I think a couple, three considerations is one, personally, when you're out in those areas, it is a good idea. Again, you can consider some of these insecticide-treated clothes so the chiggers that get on the pants or whatnot will not be able to survive long enough. Secondly, after you're done, get in the shower. Do a nice shower, a good toweling off, because there you got a good chance of removing the critters before they get a chance to move in. Now, you know, times when they really get to be problematic, let's say on a picnic bench out in your backyard and you want to use it, then I almost think you treat them like ticks in that the permethrin treatments that you could spray on the grass or whatnot should knock the populations down. And it's not like you've got to do it every day, you know, once every couple weeks at best. And chiggers do seem to be somewhat seasonal in the sense when they're really bad, within a couple, 3 weeks, they seem to get better. But again, unfortunately, the dynamic environment of a prairie, I can see as being a great place because there's a lot of insects there, and these are predators on insects, and they're taking advantage of it. And I don't know any other way to manipulate that given the environment.
So as long as David's got that prairie behind him, he's got those chiggers out there waiting.
Yeah. One of the most common complaints I would get because they seem to be in kind of isolated environments per se. People that go into the raspberry patches picking, you know, it's just a combination of plant cover and moisture and whatnot is a place that chiggers seem to do quite well. So as I said, you can sometimes define at least areas you're a little concerned about. But the problem, again, it's not like the minute they get on you, you know it. And so you kind of have to walk some of these things back. And as I said, if I get into areas, I consider, you know, long socks and whatnot in treated clothing. And as I said, if I'm really concerned, I do the shower trick.
David, thank you for the call. We'll go to Sue in Bowler next. Sue, hi.
Hi. I have a trouble with, I think it's a beetle-type bug. It's smaller, kind of oval-shaped, like bright yellow and black stripes, I believe, and it makes these little black spots on, it'll cover like my mint, oregano, some shrubs, just different.
How big leaves. Is this? How big is this beetle, Sue?
It's maybe the size of a, like Japanese, you know, what we call ladybugs. But it's more kind of flat and oval.
And yellow and black?
Yeah.
Huh.
Like when you first started, I thought we're going to talk about cucumber beetles, but they're picking on plants that cucumber beetles have no interest. To be honest, there is a four-line plant bug that is yellow and black. It feeds on a wide variety of plants. Its waste would be more likely liquidy, which would leave the spots, versus most beetles, their waste is more hardened, and so it'd be more like pepper. The thing about plant bugs is when they feed, they literally burn holes in the leaves. And so their damage, honestly, is quite characteristic. You'll see a number of feeding areas, but it's not like big holes are chewed. It's like they're burnt into the plant. So I'm really suspicious. Now, as far as stuff, most standard garden insecticides would work. I would even think insecticidal soap would give you a pretty good chance because it's soft-bodied. Insecticidal soaps don't work as well on beetles because their hard outer shell protects them somewhat. But as I said, I'm just speculating with the diversity of plants and what's going on that you might be running into four-line plant bug. My experience with it is you have a bad year for it, then you don't see them for 3 or 4 years. It's not like they're quite as constant as some other insects.
The four-line plant bug and an insecticide soap may be the best solution for Sue?
Well, I mean, the nice thing about insecticidal soap, you know, you can put it on edible plants. Mm-hmm. It doesn't harm anything other than what it touches. And honestly, it doesn't even have any residual, which is both good and bad. So that would be one option. But most standard garden insecticides that are labeled for plants would also give you the knockdown. The difference, the insecticides would tend to have a couple days of knockdown power, whereas the insecticidal soap only works on what it touches.
Sue, thank you for the call. We'll go next to Martha in Sauk City. Martha, hi.
Good morning. It's so great to hear your voice, Phil Pelletieri. You've advised me in the past. Currently, we are experiencing a major invasion around our house of millipedes. We live in a wooded area. It's been moist, obviously. But I have a couple of questions. How long will the season last for the millipedes? And I don't particularly want to spray, certainly inside the house. Some get in the house. But how should I control them outside? Thanks.
Sure. So, you know, we go in certain times when we get millipede migrations, is probably the best way to put it, where they literally move at night by incredible numbers. And then when the sun comes up, they're looking for places that are cool, damp, and dark. So they get on the garage floor, but they also crawl in underneath your siding and end up in the house. I can assure you they can't breed indoors. They don't hurt anything. They're just a mess, and they sound crunchy when you walk on them. In extreme cases, Stan Temple had done an experiment. We had, back when I was on campus, he was watching a particular millipede and how far it could move. And honestly, he tracked it well over 100 yards.
Oh.
So it turns out that a lot of times when you start to see the problems, you got to start thinking, where is there an accumulation of organic matter and moisture far enough away from the house? It's not my lawn grass, but it's usually, again, an area of woods that has an awful lot of leaf litter, those kind of things. And so in the extreme cases, when you treat, that's what you do is you treat that outside barrier. to kind of put up an area before they get to you. And I agree, indoors, it's a waste of time. But the other thing to consider is that if you can solve the riddle of how they get in, you can make things a little better. And the weakness of most houses is where the siding meets the foundation. There's enough of a seam. Maybe you don't get an airflow problem, but insects like earwigs and millipedes can crawl up underneath there, and then they spill into the basement and the other places. And so the ideal thing, if you get lucky enough to find that physical weakness and get that plugged, then you don't worry so much. How long is a good question? Again, I think the dryness that we're experiencing now is going to slow them up considerably. And usually what we speculate that this population explosion, they're migrating from the area because it's there's not enough food and environment for them. So they're looking for greener pastures. So we'll wait and see. Usually it's about a 2 to 3 week period of time. But there are times I have seen numbers where people would literally be able to sweep up bucketfuls on their sidewalk or on their garage floor for a couple of weeks. And it gets very frustrating. But again, the argument, there's no reason to spray the garage floor because that's not where they're coming from. You got to figure out more from the distance where they're marching through and try to stop them there.
Find that dark, moist source where they're coming from, Martha, and thank you for that creepy call. I appreciate that. Phil Pilateri joining us, entomologist and former head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. Taking your questions, and we go to Jeff and Jackson next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. It's kind of an unusual question. I've noticed that my elm are very healthy on my property, and I used to collect a lot of morels from underneath them. And I'm wondering if I would be able to, you know, saw on a tree that is infected that has some flagging and sign of Dutch elm disease and transfer that to other elms to see if I can promote the Dutch elm so I could get more morels from underneath them, because I have a ton of healthy elm trees. It seems like ever since Emerald Ash Borer moved through, the elms have been just taking off, and there's very, very few that are showing signs of distress from Dutch elm. Or is this just throwing a dart at the board, or is there a way that you think I might be able to inoculate an elm tree?
Okay, well, I guess what I'll share with you is what I experienced on a property that I'm lucky enough to hunt. And they do a lot of quality timber management where they girdle trees, which will eventually kill them. Well, guess what? When they girdle a hillside that's got elms on it, the morels take advantage of it. Transferring Dutch elm disease by yourself, it is primarily spread both by insects in their feeding, but also by roots if the elms share roots. And so it's a problem there. I just don't know ways of inoculating it. So I guess what I would consider, you've got the spores in your area. And so, again, if you pick select trees that really aren't important to you, that you wouldn't mind if Dutch elm disease were to get, and try the girdling, you know, it's going to go a slow process, but that will provide the kind of environment, I think, that you've got a chance for morels. And there's nothing wrong if you've got a morel that, you know, you've got some spores from, of spreading it in the area as being hopeful. But as I said, I think the main thing is to have the trees weakened enough that they're in decline, and that's what the mushroom is going to take advantage of.
Jeff, thank you for the call. Let's go next to Ross in Middleton. Hi, Ross.
Hey, Ray and Bill. The question is about bats and bat houses. A friend of mine noticed that the young bats this year had fallen out or had dropped from the box and were dead. And the thought was is that it was due to bed bugs or some kind of a bed bug insect. Have you heard about this? Is there something, it might be more of a bat question, but I'm just wondering if you've heard about this with bats, and is there anything that they might be able to do if it is that?
Sure. So there definitely is a bed bug associated with bats. It looks almost identical to the human bed bug. And on occasion, I would get one in the lab when somebody found it in the house. And in fact, I used to see this more before 2000 when human bed bugs were really quite unusual before that time in the state. I don't know if I've ever seen their numbers built up enough to kill bats. I won't say it's impossible, but the only way I think you could prove that is to get up and get a look into the bat house, and there should be lots of critters. They'd like to hide in the seams of the house and whatnot. You would see them. Unfortunately, in the middle of the year when the bats are making use of it, I don't know if there is a registered treatment for it. If there were no bats in the house and the like, honestly, you could use, you know, permethrin or something that, you know, it's got labeled for chickens and the like, and knock it down. But as I get, I think I'd do some more investigating. I think it's a valid question to ask. I just have not seen enough numbers. The other thing that should be a bit of a giveaway, if you were to even look in there, classic bed bugs, when they feed, is they leave little black waste spots, almost like little tar spots on things. And so there should be evidence on the side of the walls and even a little bit on the outside of the house, possibly, of this bed bug waste, which would, again, at least lead us towards that direction. It's something that I've seen, but as I said, I don't know if I ever remember a case where I thought, boy, that bat died because there was too many bed bugs.
That is fascinating. I had no idea there was a connection between the bed bugs that could be in our house and the bats that could be in the bat house and the damage that these bugs might do. Thank you so much, Ross, for the call. Let's go to Tegan and Nina next. Tegan, hi.
I really like to study bugs. So if I want to study bugs when I'm a grown-up, what should I do?
Well, I think you just keep your interest. I mean, when I was young, I used to collect butterflies. I thought that was lots of fun. And then as I went on, you know, you can collect bugs, put them in a little bug house, watch them for a couple of days, and then you can let them go. It's not like you have to keep them. So I would just go. I mean, sometimes you get lucky enough in your area. Some of the local zoos will have insect zoos, you know, during the summer. So there are places you can visit, museums, the same kind of thing. I think those are ways of cultivating your interest. Another thing you might consider is there is something called the Wisconsin Entomological Society. It is basically a group of amateurs and professionals. They have at least a couple meetings a year. Sometimes there's Zoom meetings and the like. And you could become a member of that and get a chance to both meet other people. And, you know, some of those people are just photographers. I mean, people from all kinds of interests are involved with the Entomological Society, and that might be fun for you to get some exposure to, and again, be able to meet some other people that like insects.
Tegan, it's a great question. Stay curious, keep asking questions, and find folks that like yourself that love bugs and want to learn more about them, and keep going. That's kind of exciting, Phil, to think that the next generation of entomologists, I'm just assuming, Tegan, you're younger than me, but the next generation of entomologists still have questions about our little bug world and how important and big it is to all of us.
Yeah, you can tell I got addicted early. Although, interesting enough, I did not go to the university originally. I was going to become a wildlife ecologist, and I took a course in entomology for grins, and then I never left. And so, but I like the outdoors enough that, you know, there was an easy association, as I said, and I did have some interest when I was younger in insects. So.
But there is this connection between the ecology and how essential our insect world is to it. What's the quote? That if we were to fall off the face of the earth tomorrow, the earth would go on. But if insects were to fall off the face of the earth, it would be pretty much a doomed planet.
Definitely. There's no question. And again, biologically, that's an easy argument to make.
Ecologically, it's an easy argument to make. Phil Pelletieri is our guest, an entomologist. Not at the outset, but he took a class for laughs and made all the difference in the world, and it might for you as well, Tegan. Thank you so much again for the call. Phil's a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014. And again, the Wisconsin Entomological Society might be a place to pursue for all ages who are interested in insects. And we've got your questions ahead for the next hour. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, or if you have a picture of an insect or bug you'd need identifying, you can send that to talk@WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News. All things insects on the Lee Rayburn Show, with your questions and your observations for our guest, Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist and the retired head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. And let's get right back to it. We'll go to Cindy in Madison next. Cindy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I have killer cicada wasps in the front of my house. Probably about 4 years ago, I saw one hole. I didn't know what it was. And over the next 2 years, I continued to see more. It's always where my sidewalk meets my flower beds or my grass. Today, like many of the days now, I'm seeing a good 20 or 30 flying around. I think they're mating right now. Today, I watched one actually dig a hole and then fly off and come back with a cicada and put it in, because I've read about them, how they feed their egg, the paralyzed cicada. My question is, are they increasing in numbers, do you think, because of the warmer winters we have been having lately, just because they like my yard? I mean, I went from seeing just one to now they're everywhere in the front of my yard, and just in the morning where it's warm, and I think they're warming up, and they're mating right now and digging their little holes.
Huh. Phil?
So a couple things. I, when I first started as an entomologist in Madison, we did not see these cicada-killing wasps at all. It was an Indiana insect. And this is one of those examples to me that the changing climate and the warming conditions have allowed it to move in. So now they become quite common. As far as their behavior, the males are very territorial. And so if they get an area, and it's been an area that often they themselves developed in, they will go patrolling around and appear very aggressive. You really have some very impressive numbers to see that many. And so, you know, you got to consider a couple things. The males are absolutely harmless. They can't sting. I don't know if anybody's ever been stung by a female, but I don't think I would ever want to experience that. It's a big enough critter, and if the venom in its stinger can paralyze the cicada, I'm not so sure it would be a pleasant experience. But because this is not a true nest, when you think of like a bald-faced hornet or whatnot, they're very aggressive because they're defending a nest. These things are only provisioning a hole in the ground. And as you had mentioned, they put the cicada in, they lay an egg. One of the fascinating things is that it will develop into a male or a female depending on how much food is available. But that, you know, that's just kind of an interesting sideline.
Yes.
As far as options, to me, it's more about changing the environment as best you can. When I used to get complaints a lot in, let's say, a somewhat open flower bed, it seemed like a pretty good way to deal with it, honestly, is to mulch. Well, they don't seem to like to dig through the mulch as much as they do the bare soil. Where I'm a little more concerned is that interface between your sidewalk and your lawn, if it's open enough that they're utilizing that. You know, and under extreme conditions, if you had to mess with them, what you would do is dust the cicada hole entrances as they go in. So you don't have to spray the critter when it's there. You just have to get it when it comes and goes. But, you know, I think that's kind of a last resort, because, as they said, they're really pretty much harmless. And, I mean, cicadas have always been here and the like. But your numbers, I think, are high enough. I can see why they're a concern, definitely.
Cindy, I would not want killer cicada wasps in my yard for certain. And I thank you for the call. And I was just thinking about the image of those wasps carrying a paralyzed cicada back to its lair. It's a little bit creepy and certainly not native. There's the other story. And Phil, I wanted to ask you about earwigs, because I see them every summer now, but maybe it's my memory. I don't remember earwigs as a kid. Are those like killer cicada wasps, relatively new to Wisconsin?
Yes, but I got a fondness in my heart, because when I first started in the lab in 78, the only earwigs we got were along the shoreline in Milwaukee. And being so wise, I said, you know, maybe this is an artifact of a milder winter there because of the lake effect.
Oh.
About 3 or 4 years later, in the early 80s, the plague hit Madison, and it was so atrocious that it was on every TV station. It was in the newspaper front page a couple of times. And it was like a science fiction movie. I mean, just going from nothing to everywhere.
The invasion of the earwigs.
Right. So their biology is quite interesting, because they live in the ground during the spring. And the mothers literally take some maternal care of the eggs and the young, and it's usually about the end of May that they start to emerge. They're active at night. They are technically omnivorous, but they really are more plant feeders. So they used to eat, you couldn't see a marigold in my neighborhood when those numbers were that high. They just chew it down. But you go out there during the day and nothing is there. They'd feed on basil. They'd feed on all kinds of plants. But the only way you could convince people is to go out at the flashlight, and then you'd see them crawling all over.
Oh, yeah.
Now, what happens with their biology is when the sun comes up, they're looking places that are cool, damp, and dark. And so that often drives them along the foundation of the house and up in the house. And then you get freaked out because you got this thing that looks like a cockroach and behaves like a cockroach. And I can assure you that they're not breeding inside, that everything is migrating in. So like we talked about before, if you can solve the riddle, you know, that they're getting in through a vent fan in the basement and you can caulk that fine. If things get quite extreme, again, you can treat, but you don't even treat the plants they're eating. You treat the areas around it where they're coming up through at night. But what I find fascinating is how bad they were there. I have not seen an earwig in my yard this summer that I can remember. And when they come out in May, the numbers are the highest. And then as you go along in the summer, their numbers start to dwindle. And there's only one generation a year. I expect them to be worse in lush years, in lush situations. So hosta beds have a lot more earwigs than you have in a very exposed flower bed. And again, there are cases I can understand when they do enough plant damage you need to treat. But again, you treat the mulch, not the plants, if that needs to be done. But to me, this is the classic I have experienced with especially exotic insects that move in the state, is that when they first get here, their populations just surge because there's no natural controls. And then usually we see a decline, and sometimes we get quite lucky with the decline. So as I said, earwigs, they are a non-issue in my garden, have been a non-issue for the last 20 years, I would argue.
I've had a few in my house, and I think the thing that's unnerving about them to me is the pinchers they have on their back ends there. What are they for?
Yeah, well, so first of all, you can tell if it's a boy or a girl by the size of the pincers. The males have a much pronounced cerci is what we officially call them. They're somewhat defensive. Honestly, I think they're probably somewhat too something with mating as far as sexual recognitions and the like. But they really look a lot worse than they are. On the other hand, I won't say they can't pinch because they are capable. But most of the time, they just kind of rear them up. They curl their abdomen and kind of look scary is what they're trying to do, I think, in the like. And again, and going back to the good news is they're not breeding in the house. But if they keep coming in, you got to start thinking. You know, you can make adjustments in the planting along your foundation to keep things drier.
Yeah.
That would put less of them. And as I said, and if you get lucky enough to figure what they might be squeezing through and get that plugged up, I think that's the direction to go in. And if it's just starting now, that's good news. Because as I said, if things were going to get bad, it would have been probably early June that you started to see the invasion.
The invasion of the earwig. Phil Pelletieri joining us along with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Carrie and Tomahawk next. Carrie, hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm growing dahlias, gladiolas, snapdragons, and thrips have been a huge problem for me. So are there any effective control methods for home gardeners that won't harm pollinators?
Yeah, somewhat, although it's a little interesting. You know, things like gladiolas, one of the problems is the thrip associated with that comes in with the corms.
Huh.
So, if you know, honestly, gladiola growers literally treat their corms in the fall of the year to knock the thrips down to alleviate that. And you've got enough diversity. It would surprise me if it's the same species of thrip that's picking on everything. So that would be something to consider. Now, as far as material, the one product I think about, there's a product that I know under the name spinosad. It's an organically derived insecticide. It's sold under Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew and I'm sure other commercial names. I will warn you when you go to the store to buy stuff, please look at the active ingredient. One of the most frustrating things I have found professionally is they keep changing the active ingredient and calling the same thing. So even though I know Dr. Jack should be spinosad, I can't guarantee you. So that's the one thing. It is not overly toxic to bees. One of the arguments is don't spray when there are bees present. Often because of that, it's good to go out just close to dusk to treat. And usually one treatment for thrips should give you a couple weeks' worth of control. In fact, hopefully knock them down enough that you don't have to retreat. So it's not like you have to keep going after them. But that is quite frustrating because, you know, thrips concentrate on flowers. They literally, I think of their feeding almost like a very tiny little file, and they rasp the surface. And, of course, that tissue does not heal. But again, I think you might want to do a little more digging. And in particular with the gladiolas, I think I would look into maybe there's some things you can do to treat the corms and kind of knock it out before you even get into the next season.
Carrie, thank you for the call. And Brett in Madison is next. Hi, Brett.
Great show. I'm glad Phil's staying with us in the bug beat. So you kind of pointed out this, but with all these extreme heat events, and union concerned scientists estimates we'll have winters like Arkansas with radical climate change. What sort of bugs do we have to, you know, look forward to? Obviously, there's mosquitoes, a dengue fever, and more ticks with Lyme disease.
Yeah, well, you know, again, one of the things, you know, I have a book that I have mostly written but never published. One of the fascinating things to me, and I pulled this line on public radio, I'm sure 20 years ago, that the governor moved us to Missouri and didn't tell us, because that's what things have felt like, whether we call about the cicada killers or what, things that are normally seen south of us migrating north because of the lack of winters. So I would say if you would look at the major pests of Arkansas, gives you a pretty good hint. And maybe we've got some of them in both states, but the ones we don't have that they have are the ones that you can expect to be coming. And this is just talking what we would call native insects that are North American. You know, there's no way to predict what's going to happen with these non-native critters, unfortunately. But that's the general direction that, you know, many insects have a certain threshold of temperature that kills them. And when you don't have those extreme cold temperatures, that allows the insects to migrate up. And so, yes, we are continuing to see ticks. Lone star tick was probably the big one.
Yes.
That I kind of saw in my career because they did not breed in the state when I first started. And my colleague, Susan Paskowitz, with her study of Lyme disease, among other things, started to get breeding populations in the Arboretum. Now it's got to be a good close to 20 years. And so right away, but that was a classic example because, again, if I wanted them, I'd go down to Missouri and take a hike in the woods. But now they are something that definitely in the southern third of the state, at least, can be found.
I have a question. Brett, thank you for calling. I have a question from Lynn. She called, couldn't stay with us. She's looking to control her carpenter ants. And there's an email from Arne and Jess here. They found frass under their table saw and are wondering if it could be carpenter ants. And then there's me, who sees carpenter ants out on the porch in pretty big numbers and a few starting to straggle into the house. What should we be thinking about when it comes to carpenter ants in the summer, Phil?
Okay, so one thing is to not overreact in the sense that there are carpenter ants on everybody's property. They live in dead trees. That's what they do. They do migrate into the house for food. So if they're just showing up in the kitchen and whatnot, it's not a problem. If you see the sawdust or frass coming out of your window frame, it's a different story. But the misconception is that the ants eat wood. And the reality is they live in soft and weakened wood. So I would make the argument that the windowsill was rotting, and then the ants moved into that environment. They get into styrofoam. It's got nothing to do with wood or water, but it's soft. So they're looking for soft substrates. The best way to control them is if you know where the nest is. They're easily controlled because there's only a single queen. Unfortunately, the colonies can live for a number of years, so it can be a growing problem. So brand new house, don't expect a problem. An old house that could have problems in the roof. And that's another example. You know, they come in, they have to replace some boards, they're rotten. They tend to blame the ants, but I would argue it's the water that ruined it, and the ants have just moved in. So any ants in the winter, you know they're nesting in the doors, you got to go after them. The table saw one is getting kind of tough because, you know, you generate sawdust when you're cutting.
Yes.
Usually, though, the frass that they kick out, because it's kind of like their garbage pile, there are little insect fragments and other things that they cannot digest mixed in with it. So you see a leg here, a wing there, that kind of stuff. And to me, again, that is a blessing because wherever it's falling out from is a good indicator that you're not either right on top of the nest or very close by, and it tells you when to treat. Now, in extreme cases, where, you know, people are just getting frustrated. And again, this is more, I think, for the nuisance side of it, is it used to be, you know, you could spray the outside foundation of your house once a month in the summer. And the sprays that we used didn't really kill the ants as much as it repelled them.
Mm-hmm.
But that gave you the results you wanted. What changed is there's an active ingredient called fipronil. The pest control industry can use it quite readily. Homeowners, to get a hold of it, other than you put it on your dog, as frontline. But to find registered products for use as an outside barrier treatment, usually you have to go to these do-your-own pest controls and have it shipped to you, because they just don't market to homeowners. But the crazy thing about this product is you spray the foundation once, you're done for the year, maybe for 2 or 3 years.
Huh.
It does not repel them, but when they move through it, they pick it up. And the fascinating thing about it is that when they go back to the nest, they take it with them. So the people that started doing the research could prove that you could wipe out a colony in the oak tree that's, you know, 30 yards from your house by treating your foundation if you had to. So again, in extreme cases, whether you have it professionally done or you do it yourself, but my experience in my own home, when I did it once, I have not seen it, and I'm at like 6 years post-treatment, and I have not seen any sign. And I did have a little bit of soft wood in a couple spots, but it solved it. Now, another change is I used to have a beautiful oak tree in the front yard that unfortunately had to be taken out. So there are no trees that I would suspect could become infested on my property. But I bet you my neighbors have got them. And again, ants can forage, you know, up to 100 yards and mostly active at night. We used to tease about sometimes to put out something like cat food, let the ants find it. You don't kill them. You trail them. When they go back to their nest, you get out with a flashlight, and honestly, if they disappear into a railroad tie in your backyard, you know right where they are, and you can treat them.
Fipronil was what it was called, Phil?
Yeah, fipronil is the active ingredient, and again, it is a commercial formula, but it is not a restricted-use pesticide. Restricted-use pesticides are highly toxic. You have to be state-certified to even buy the stuff or apply it. But this is a product for marketing purposes, and I won't even get into the legal things that companies do between each other. That's a whole bunch of jokes, but you can tell I'm an old guy. It turns out that it does not have registration for indoor use for any purposes, but it does have registration for outside use as a barrier treatment. And as I said, if you go on to national sites that sell to homeowners, you can look through and they'll have products that, you know, you just mix up and you spray a band, you know, maybe a foot out from the foundation up a couple inches and you're done.
Nice. Let's go to Susie in Manitowoc next. Susie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have an earwig story, which is a little bit of a guilty conscience.
Huh.
Okay. We were camping on Winter Island in Massachusetts. And with our youngest son, we were in our camper. He was in a tent. He came in the middle of the night and said, "Can I come in and sleep with you in here? Because these bugs are biting me all to pieces." Well, we took up the tarp in the morning, and they were earwigs covered with them, thousands of earwigs. Well, we left that campsite. But then we came home, shook out our tent poles, and the earwigs were in our tent poles. So we feel a little conscious for bringing earwigs back to Wisconsin from Massachusetts.
What year would this have been, Susie?
Oh, early 90s.
Okay.
Yeah, 90s.
You want to let Susie off the hook, Phil?
Yeah, I can understand your concern, but as I had mentioned, I mean, it hit the fan in the early 80s, if not before. And so they have been transported. And that was the interesting thing. I mean, earwigs, although they have wings, can't fly worth a darn. They rely on, you know, whether you're talking potted plants that are shipped across state borders or whatnot, there's lots of ways they can get in, or they have to walk. And so, again, you know, when they were so bad here in Madison in the 80s, they hadn't gotten up to Bayfield. It only took about 15 years, but that's a long walk if
yeah.
you think about it. And, you know, and so
it's
it
a long drive.
A matter of time before they migrate. You know, if you go to Arizona, we have native earwigs in the United States, not in Wisconsin, and there are earwigs that live in the desert. But the one that we have here is technically called the European earwig, and as I said, we even though we had a few records, it really didn't get start to get crazy in the state until the late 70s.
You're off the hook, Susie, and thank you for the call. We had a listener call Garden Talk last week when we had Dr. Death on from the UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. The question was about magnolia scale, and some years are better than others, Phil, but how is this year looking?
Early to tell. You know, you really don't know you got things going on till you get well into August and then into September.
Okay.
Generally, although, you know, sometimes you might start to pick up the honeydew on the leaves now as they're feeding heavily, but the problem is when you think you need to treat is not the right time. A magnolia scale is best treated very late into the September and October. And so anytime you see signs of activity on your plants earlier than that, you kind of have to mark the calendar, but don't waste your time with spraying the trees right now because it's not going to get you anywhere. And it's hard to predict. That's, again, an example of a native insect, at least as far as I know. I never saw a magnolia scale when I first started. And then all of a sudden, they seem to take off. And as I said, I assume it's a bit of a climate issue. But magnolia, again, we're just kind of on the northern fringe, so it all makes sense. If the magnolias are doing better, the critters that feed on them are doing better.
Now, also, Japanese beetles. We've had them here for a number of years now. And these sort of scarab beetles that certainly don't seem to be native, what can we do, if anything, about them?
Particularly frustrating because they migrate in from well down the road. They are active for almost 2 months. Usually starts a little end of June, and they feed on such a wide variety of plants. And so I highly suggest not to mess with your lawn. You know, some people say you treat your lawn and kill the grubs. Well, okay, if they were bad enough to kill your lawn, then you need to treat. I've known a couple golf courses, but I have never seen those kind of populations, and it's always migrating in. Again, to tell an old war story, I live about two blocks from a golf course. When they were at their heyday, and I remember when they first were introduced into this or first took off in the state back in James and whatnot. And of course, we knew what was coming because of the problems out east. But during the heyday in Madison, there was not a birch tree or a linden tree or a rose bush in my neighborhood that even had a leaf on it.
Mm.
I mean, people tease me, but I call it like a science fiction movie. It was that bad. I'm in the process of dealing with Japanese beetles now. I have killed maybe 50 in the last 4 weeks by going out there and with my butterfly net and disposing of them. When things were bad, I had a yellow potentilla that I never saw a flower on. My plant's doing just fine now. So I always used to kind of warn people, or not warn people, but at least give them a hope that down the road, if they're just getting to be holy hell, down the road, it's going to get better for you. But I can still show you pockets in Madison, you know, relatively new developments and the like, that have enough problems that they have to deal with. What's particularly frustrating, lots of things you can spray on, but whatever you spray on only lasts a few days. Try to concentrate on what they want to feed on. Again, an old story, but they used to pick on some of my plants, and I knocked them down. And what I found is they moved over to my neighbor's cotoneaster hedge, and they left me alone. What you will see is when they feed on plants, it attracts other ones. I mean, the females attract, usually you find them coupling one way or another when they're on your plants. But it seems that the volatiles that are given off on the injured leaves also cause them to be attracted. And so if you can concentrate and catch them early, you can often make a difference, especially when the numbers are on the downside rather than the craziness that when they first establish.
Phil, I want to thank you for the stories today. I want to thank you for giving us a perspective of the world that's a little bit different and certainly appreciating our insect world. It's great to talk to you, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Lee.
Phil Pelletieri is an entomologist and a distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. He retired as the head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab in 2014, where PJ Leash now runs that show. Sorry we didn't get to all the questions and calls, but for certain we will return to the conversation about our bug world next month. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to WPR News.